Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
We pay them to keep and regulate our towns. Why should I be scared every time I see them? Why should I be fearful for somebody that is supposed to embody the American dream?
Coming up, we'll hear from a recent rally in Chicago protesting police killing people of color.
And that's why I ended up doing a historical project that traced back many of these battles and some of these answers to policy debates in the 1940s.
And we'll hear from the author of a new book about media activism in the 1940s, its successes and shortcomings, and the lessons for today. Plus, we'll hear a special message about this very show from the trenches. But first, here are some headlines from the Worldwide Indie Media Network with Kemi Adioken.
Puerto Rico Indie Media featured a story about a labor union at a Pepsi plant winning a new collective agreement. On March 9, 2015, members of the Trade Union Solidarity Movement, representing 300 employees of a manufacturing plant that makes Pepsi products in Toja Baja, Puerto Rico, fought off threats by management of eliminating worker rights and benefits amid a poor economy. The union was able to keep its jobs, raise wages, improve benefits, and increase employer contributions to employee health benefits. Santa Cruz Indie Media featured protests to raise awareness around the death, overcrowding, and lack of health care inside California jails and prisons, and create a space for community empowerment. Quoting from the feature dated February 4, 2015, at least six people have died in the Santa Cruz County Jail since August of 2012, while in the hands of Sheriff's Department and California Forensics Medical Group. In light of the most recent death in November 2014, community-based organization Sinvaras, which fights to abolish prisons and the prison industrial complex, held a demonstration on January 24th in downtown Santa Cruz. Activists circulated flyers demanding, among other things, canceling the contract with California Forensics Medical Group and abolishing solitary confinement, administrative segregation, and use of a so-called torture chair, formerly called a restraint chair for treating prisoners. Boston Indie Media featured a rally to preserve efforts to wind-powered renewable energy. Quoting from the feature dated February 28, 2015, there was a large rally today on Boston Common at Park Street to save the Cape Wind project to build a wind farm with windmill-powered turbines off the Massachusetts coast. It was organized by www.betterfutures.org, as well as other environmental and renewable source energy organizations. Their goal was to emphasize the benefits of wind power as a safe and clean energy force. The event included live music, street theater, and numerous speakers. Portland Indie Media reported on April 12, 2015 about a vigil for Keaton Otis, a Portland victim of police violence. Otis was a young African-American man who was shot 23 times by Portland police in 2010 after being stopped for alleged suspicious behavior. This was, quoting from another source, because he failed to signal a turn and because they thought the 25-year-old African-American man looked and drove like a gangster. Otis was tasered and shot after being pulled over. Before the incident, Otis had been diagnosed with severe depression. Quoting from the Portland Indie Media article, the monthly vigil is on the 12th in Northeast Portland and is held at 6 p.m. on Northeast 6th and Housley. In May 2015, there is a yearly memorial scheduled for Keaton called We Remember. More info on where and when will be posted on Portland Indie Media. Chicago Indie Media featured an update on the Chicago mayoral race on April 8, 2015, entitled Voldemort Wins Second Term as Chicago Mayor, referring to the main villain in the Harry Potter series of books and films. Quoting from the article, Rahm Emanuel has held an overwhelming spending advantage, as much as $45 million spent in the 2015 primary and runoff by some estimates, along with a media saturation and smear campaign, and reports of ballots pre-marked for Rahm. Some 1.1 million out of 1.4 million registered Chicago voters, nearly four-fifths of all registered Chicago voters, did not vote for Rahm. And one progressive voting organizer has declared, "The Rahm Emanuel we know is broken." Even so, Chicagoans can expect four more years of continued budget cuts, suspicious fiscal policies, various administration scandals, and protests against all of the above.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. You're listening to audio from April 14th, 2015, the A14 Shut It Down March. The it in question is the unwarranted killing people of color by police in Chicago and nationwide, an issue that has certainly grabbed popular attention in late 2014 and early 2015. A nationwide protest on unwarranted police killings took place nationwide on April 14th, 2015. Chicago was represented in the protest as more than 200 gathered in Daley Plaza in downtown Chicago. We'll now hear audio from some of those individuals who spoke at the rally.
I just want to say that, you know, we really should be a threat. I think we really are a threat. I think we need to become more of a threat to the status quo.
Yes!
To the status quo that says black lives don't matter. To the status quo that says they enslaved Africans 500 years ago and continue killing people of color. Slavery to this day. And we gotta say, yes, it is all cops. It is every single cop. Because they uphold an institution of white supremacy. The very first cop stations in this country were slave patrol. It was the slave patrol, and many ways it continues to be that way today in our community. So we really should be a threat. And when we say hands up, we say fight back. Hands up,
fight back!
Hands up,
fight back!
Hands up,
fight back!
Because this won't be over until the purple gets out of our neighborhoods, out of our communities. We won't apologize, and we don't have to be peaceful. We won't be peaceful, in fact. We're tired of being peaceful while you kill us, while you murder us, while you rape us, while you deport us.
We have the power!
Now, don't misunderstand me when I say I am not a threat. If my back is turned to you, I am not a threat.
All right.
But let it be known, if my front is shown, the fight is real.
Yo,
Yes, we also have Mark Clemens here. He's one of the torture victims of John Byrne for 28 years. Make some noise, make some noise, make some noise! Hands up! Hands up!
Hands up!
Hands up!
Hands up!
Hands up!
Hands up!
It is a shame that in America that we can constantly seem to spend millions and millions of taxpayer hard-earned dollars for police shootings. Why? There's no accountability.
Why?
There's no accountability in this building over there. Why? Because the people fail to realize that it is you who have the power, not them.
Stand up.
This morning, the Finance Committee approved a $20 million reparation package for Chicago police torture victims, category John Byrne's torture victims. I believe that every individual in the city of Chicago that have been a victim of torture must be compensated by the city of Chicago. $20 million is a start, but it also represents as one of the lowest reparation packages in U.S. history for over, some say, 114 victims, some say 157, some say over 200 victims of torture.
Hi everyone, my name is Amanda Wilkerson, I'm a junior. I pay over $38,000 a year to get an education so I can function in this society, so I can get a good job, so I can come home to my family and friends and be happy. Tony Robinson in Madison was shot in his own home, dragged out of his home, dead, handcuffed after he was dead, brains on his front porch. This is not right. He was shot by cops, unarmed, in his own home. He graduated from high school. He had the same vision that I did, to live in a society where he was equal to another person who had his high school or college degree. I'm tired of being scared walking home when I see a cop. When we see cops, we pay them to keep us safe. We pay them to keep and regulate our towns. Why should I be scared every time I see them? Why should I be fearful for somebody that is supposed to embody the American dream? Like, this is America, home of the free, right? Home of the free, land of the brave. Are we brave? We're here to stop this. For everybody who ignores this, this is something that happens every single day. Every single day you hear about somebody else being shot in the back or shot after being handcuffed or beaten up. I don't know if you guys saw that one video of six to eight cops beating on that man, kicking him in his head, a kick to the head. That is attempted murder. One kick, you could be dead. All these cops tasing people one time, 20,000 volts, 50,000 volts. That is attempted murder. We need to stop this. This is not right. I'm a junior in college, and I want to live until I'm 50, till I'm 80, till however old. I don't want to keep hearing about 17-year-old kids, 7-year-old kids, 89-year-old women and men being murdered down, shot down in the streets. The police are supposed to bring us to justice. They are not supposed to handle justice by their own hands in the street on unarmed people, people that are not a threat. This needs to stop. Shut it down.
Shut it down. Shut it down. Shut it down. Yes.
So next we have one of the families that has been in the struggle the longest, fighting this nightmare, fighting for justice. I give you... Daphne Wilson and Latrice Wilson. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh. Well, we know him affectionately as Godfather. Please welcome.
Yes, my name is Freddie McGee. My son was murdered by Chicago police And what I have to say today, I'd like to ask a question to all the police, to their wives, to their mothers, and to their grandmothers when they go out for their job, to their children that they leave home. What do they be thinking about? What do they be thinking about when they come out here and they start shooting innocent people accidentally on purpose or however they do it? Don't they realize they have children? How do their wives feel? How do their mothers feel? Do they have any conscience? They was children before they became a police officer. You know, they was children once in their life. They was fortunate enough to grow up and get a job as a police officer. You know, they don't give a child today a chance to grow up to be anything that he was supposed to be. You stop that. You stop that like you stop my son. You stop that like you stop other people's children. They grow up. You don't know. There's other presidents. Obama is a president, a black president. There could have been another black president that you took down. Or a white boy. Or a Mexican boy. Or whoever you are killing, you don't know their future. You know? So you need to stop. The mothers to the wives and all that. Think about it. Do you all have any conscience? How do you all feel when you find out that your husband went out and killed somebody innocent, shot him in the back like a dog, like a dirty dog? They are humans. We are human beings, okay? You go to the range. You go to the range. Don't you know how to shoot a gun? Have you heard of shooting? Have you ever heard of wounding someone? Is that possible to wound someone, or is it possible to kill everyone that you shoot? Stop. Please stop what you're doing. We are humans. That's all I have to say.
Indict. Convict. Send the killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. Indict. Convict. Send the killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. Cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. Killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. Alright, next we have Daphne Jackson and Latrice Jeffries from United in Peace.
Peace and blessings, family. My name is Daphne of the Uhuru Movement, and Uhuru means peace and freedom, family. And this is my good sister, Latrice Jeffries, with United in Peace. And I stand here first to tell you, family, yes, Uhuru means freedom. And I want to say that this is not anything random. We must understand there has been a war declared on Africans, not only in the U.S., but around the world. The pigs serve as an apparatus to the state for the ruling class, and their only intent is to kill us. I beseech to my people that we must unite and join together. We must recreate our black struggle, our African struggle. We must again get together, love one another, care for one another. Again, say black power. Say black power.
Black power.
Black power.
Black power.
See, brothers and sisters, once we again decide to say it loud and be proud of who we are, stop being apologetic for being African. Can we stand up and be proud of who we are? Can we continue unapologetically, sister? We have to remember who we are and the people we are. We owe no anyone an explanation. We owe anyone an apology, but we must call this for what it is. It's a blatant attack on Africans. And I ask my brothers and sisters, it's time for us to resist. We must raise up. We must resist. There was a time when we understood the word revolution and knew what it meant. But now no one wants to say it, but Daphne's going to say it, family. Revolution! Revolution! Resist! Revolution! Build our people! Build our communities! Let's build our communities, family. Black love! Black love! Black business! Black love, family! Build our communities and black power! Peace and blessings! Black power! Black power! Black power! Black power! Peace to you!
Okay, we have Justice Howell, Justice for Justice. We have Clyde McLemore. He's going to speak for Justice.
Hello, everyone. My name is Clyde McLemore. I am a community activist from Zion, Illinois. I came down to be with you to let you know our fight. On Saturday, y'all saw the incident that happened in South Carolina. It was videotaped and that police went to jail. Well, on the same day it happened, four blocks from my house, this 17-year-old kid, Justin Howell, was shot down in the back by the police in Zion, Illinois. A white police officer shot him. The same police that they in Zion right now, they won't release his name, but I do have his name. I have a complaint against this police officer in September who stopped my son in a traffic stop and pulled the gun on him. Now, Zion police took that complaint with minimum concern. Had this police have been prosecuted for my complaint, Justin would still be alive. They said there was a lady that was there. She's bedridden. She turned over and saw the first shot. She turned over and watched Justin hit the ground. He didn't have no gun, she said. She didn't see them pick up no gun. But even if you had five guns, if you're running the opposite way, you don't get shot in the back. This kid was just a rapper. That's all he wanted to do. And I ask that we keep Justin Howard, Justice for Justin, going on. Because we will be doing this again on Friday in Zion, Illinois. We've been calling. They've been having secret meetings. I'm going to say this, I'm going to shut up. Can you believe that the chief of police, the state's attorney in Lake County, and some white preachers met at a church? I was asked by the family to go over to the church. And when I got to the church, they told me I was not allowed in. I said, well, that's what Klans do. This was what y'all having, a Ku Klux Klan meeting? They brought the deputy chief, his name is Kirk Henderson, deputy chief of Zion Police over there. And he turned around and said, no, Clyde McLemore can't come in here. That's a secret meeting. How y'all gonna discuss the lives of black children in our area and you don't have our grassroots there and right there with you? This morning they had another secret meeting with the white pastors. I didn't see none of the police chief. I walked into the meeting this morning at 8 o'clock. I was up at 8 o'clock and was there at the meeting on time, and they asked me to leave. They're trying to get their story together. That's what's going on. That's what the secret is, and that's why they're having these meetings. And all I'm just saying is, young black men out here, please be careful. You can be the next Barack Obama. You can be the next senator, heart surgeon, or anything. You don't have to be shot down like dogs in the street. I'm an older man. See, what they did to us in the 80s is that they locked us all up and put charges on us and put us in jail. Now they figure out that it costs too much to house us in jail, so now they want to shoot us down so we can't have babies no more, and the black race trying to exterminate us. No, this is not going to happen. And I ask y'all to please protect your children. Thank y'all. Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot! Yes, we have more news.
1,000 demonstrators have taken the Brooklyn Bridge.
1,000 demonstrators have taken the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. 1,000. Yes. Okay, we have students Edward Ward and Elijah Obasanya from DePaul.
I'll say this and I'll be quick. For centuries, we've been trying over and over again to make a moral appeal to a racist, bigoted, misogynistic, homophobic institution that has no moral conscience. We've been asking these institutions to give us our freedom. We've been asking these institutions if it's okay for us to live. And so we're standing up today saying that we're not asking you anymore if it's okay to live. We're demanding that we will live. You won't shoot me in the back, because I don't believe in turning away and running. I believe in facing the system head on. I believe in eradicating the system of injustice. And so we've got to stand up and say enough is just about enough. He give these police officers, we give this system our power. And this day, we're saying we're taking it back. We gave you our power believing that you would protect us and our communities. And you've only done the opposite. You've only taken our lives, our father's lives, our brother's lives, our mother's lives, grandmother's, sisters. They've been beaten, they've been raped, they've been mocked. And we're saying today, at this very moment, the revolution will not be accommodating and it will not be comfortable. So get ready.
Black power!
You know, I have nothing more to say than that. He basically put everything that we've talked about in the most eloquent words possible. I just want to say that when you talk about revolution, when you talk about black revolution, that's what you hear. And that's what we all need to come to terms with. We've been having conversations in this country for hundreds of years. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, they have tried their best to have conversations to make a moral appeal. I think our generation is sick and tired of everything. We are sick and tired of asking. We're sick and tired of worrying, of crying, of caring about our brothers and sisters to the extent that we can't even function properly. We are sick and tired of it. We do this out of love. We do this out of care for human life. And with that, we say there needs to be a black revolution in this country. Thank you.
All right, we're getting ready to get going here. I just want to make sure everyone, again, has that phone number. Very important. If you need legal defense, the phone number you need to call is 1-800-529-7374. 1-800-529-7374.
That was a selection of audio from the April 14th, 2015 Shut It Down rally against the unwarranted killing people of color by police at Chicago's Daley Plaza. Additional audio from the rally in March are available online at the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One Nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching.
Popular activism on media issues has seen a number of dramatic wins in 2015, from winning a reclassified internet to help preserve net neutrality, to the defeat of a proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner Cable, to the fruition of a great many low-power FM radio stations. The activism in 2015 is a result of a great deal of effort over many years, drawing from media activist movements in the past. A recent discovery is the activism over media in the United States in the 1940s and the focus of a new book, America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. We'll speak with the author of the book, Victor Picard, in this interview with Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stupinchik, recorded on Wednesday, March 18th, 2015.
We are joined via Skype with Victor Picard. Victor Picard is an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and he has written a new book that is the focus of our discussion here. The book is entitled America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform, published by Cambridge University Press. Victor Picard, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitchell.
Let's talk in broad strokes about the book. What's the book about? Why did you write it?
Well, the book began with one big general question about a decade ago, which was, how did we in the United States come to inherit this particular kind of media system? A media system that in many sectors is dominated by a handful of corporations, a system that is only lightly regulated in terms of public interest protections, and a system that is predominantly commercial with very weak public alternatives. Taken together, this is fairly unique among democratic nations, and I wanted to figure out how did this kind of American exceptionalism come into existence? How did we get to this point? And that's why I ended up doing a historical project that traced back many of these battles and some of these answers to policy debates in the 1940s.
And that's what I'd like to talk about here, is that for a long time I had considered the 1940s, at least as far as activism on media issues, to be a kind of dead letter. There was probably a little bit of activity, but it didn't seem like, from what I knew about the period, to be a terribly big hub of activity. And yet your book, it chronicles in great detail the fact that it actually was very active and there were a lot of things. And I'd like to discuss some of that as well right now. We can begin, let's begin with the Blue Book, the FCC Blue Book. For listeners who are not familiar with it, explain what it is and why it's important.
Sure. And just to back up for a second to reference the point you made about the 1940s being kind of like flyover country between the 1930s and 60s, which is the period that I think historians are more likely to focus on if they're grappling with some of these similar kinds of questions, looking at contingencies, how could things have gone differently? But yes, I think as this discussion will show, quite a few things could have gone differently in the 1940s. And I think the Blue Book is a good place to start. It's something that's been all but forgotten today. When people hear the phrase Blue Book, they probably think about auto sales or perhaps the booklets they take with them into college classrooms to take exams. But actually, the Blue Book, which was titled Public Service Responsibilities for Broadcast Licensees, was so named because of its blue cover, was really a way or an attempt to make the broadcasters' licenses to the public airwaves — that phrase, public airwaves, can't be underscored enough — to make that contingent upon satisfying very meaningful public interest obligations. And not to keep your listeners in suspense, this ultimately was not a successful initiative, but there was quite a fight over this initiative in the mid-1940s.
What were the parameters of that fight? Who were the players at play, and what did they fight over?
To be clear about what the Blue Book was trying to do, it was trying to establish these public service responsibilities, such as broadcasters had to cover public affairs, local culture. They also had to cut down on what was referred to as excessive advertising. This is probably what freaked out commercial broadcasters the most. And, of course, broadcasters didn't take this very kindly. They were not; they did not appreciate that the FCC was trying to establish these kinds of public interest regulations. And so there was quite a counterattack, often taking the form of red-baiting, accusing the FCC of trying to censor what they referred to as free radio. They accuse the FCC of being in league with communist infiltrators. And, of course, this was at a time in the 1940s when anti-communist hysteria was beginning to take hold. So you saw a lot of very nasty rhetoric being thrown about. And ultimately, the commissioners were forced to retreat on this initiative. But they did put up a pretty good fight for about a year this policy battle took place. And there was also this emergent media reform movement in the 1940s that was very much a grassroots social movement, or at least it was taking the form of a coalition, which included various progressive groups, educators, religious organizations, civil rights groups, labor activists. So you had this very feisty media reform coalition from below and these progressive commissioners at the FCC from above. But ultimately, largely because of red baiting, they were not successful.
But the book did raise a number of points. And there's one point, well, not really a point, but probably a kind of undercurrent regarding that the Blue Book mentions and you discuss in a chapter in the book about the Blue Book, is that it kind of takes a pot shot regarding the role of markets in a responsive media in a democratic society. And it seems like there's this undercurrent saying that markets are inimical to democracy and that markets concentrate and that leads to bad consequences. Is it fair to say that there was a kind of undercurrent regarding markets of criticism that the Blue Book raised and was probably why it was attacked so fiercely?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. It's a fair assessment to suggest that there was this implication, although the phrase wasn't used, but there was an implication that you had what I refer to in my book as systemic media market failure. So this assumption, and it's based on what I refer to as a social democratic vision of the press, but an assumption that a commercial media system simply cannot deliver on all of democratic society's communication needs. And so you have to create these public safeguards to buffer the media system from these undue commercial pressures, but also to set these kind of normative parameters, these expectations. This is what a media system must deliver to the public. And in this case, it really is about a social contract, especially if you take into consideration that these commercial broadcasters were given monopolistic use of the public airwaves upon which they were able to reap tremendous profits. So the question was, what do these commercial broadcasters owe society in return? And the Blue Book was a fairly modest attempt to try to mandate this, to try to codify it, to make sure that there were deliverables, that the commercial broadcasters were giving something back to the public.
Along those lines, there was another effort through the FCC of what was referred to as the Mayflower Doctrine and how that connects with what a lot of people has been the topic of some controversy and is actually now no longer FCC policy, but the Fairness Doctrine. Talk a little bit about the Fairness Doctrine, how it kind of emerged from this period of activism, and as well as the origins and the source of what's referred to as the Mayflower Doctrine.
Yeah, so the Mayflower Doctrine, which has been completely forgotten, was something that actually the first progressive FCC chairman, James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly, introduced in 1941, which essentially prevented commercial broadcasters from politically editorializing. And this sounds pretty severe, pretty harsh, but at the time it was assumed, and in the early 40s, you were really talking about a massive duopoly. It was really just CBS and NBC. You also had a smaller network called Mutual Broadcasting System, NBS, but it was much weaker than the two big players. And so it was assumed that they had tremendous market and political power because they dominated the commercial radio system to such an extent that the FCC felt that they needed to place these, again, a kind of public interest protection to make sure that they weren't using or they weren't exploiting their monopoly market power in dominating the public airwaves. So after the Blue Book was defeated in 1946-47, broadcasters immediately looked at the Mayflower Doctrine as their next target. And they ultimately were also successful in having that repealed, which is how we ended up with the Fairness Doctrine, which is something that your listeners are probably familiar with or at least heard of. And it's quite a historical irony that even though the Fairness Doctrine is held up today, especially among progressives, as this kind of high watermark for enlightened media policy, in the 1940s, it was seen by reformers as a kind of consolation prize, a sort of derivative of a stronger, more structural regulation.
Going back to the issue regarding radio and activism around radio, it wasn't just the Mayflower Doctrine / Fairness Doctrine that was also a topic of a fight. There was also some pretty serious, and it's hard to say the word nowadays, antitrust actions that were carried out against these radio monopolies, which helped to lead to the formation of what's now the ABC radio and later television networks. Talk about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, so that was the first big structural intervention of the decade in the early 40s, again, under the leadership of Larry Fly. One of the first things that he did when he arrived at the FCC in 1939 was to take what had been a languishing report on the state of American broadcasting and turn it into what later became known as the Monopoly Report. He used it to conduct this very aggressive study into the lack of competition in radio markets across the United States. And he used the findings from that report to essentially trust bust. I mean, to be more exacting on this, he was able to pass new rules that in turn forced NBC to divest itself of one of its two major networks, which, as you noted, later became ABC. So this is pretty unthinkable for us today. This would be like Tom Wheeler passing new rules to force Comcast or Verizon to break itself into two. It's pretty inconceivable, but this is what they were doing at the FCC in the 1940s. And yet going from two big players to three big players, as you might imagine, didn't dramatically transform the radio landscape. And that's why, in a sort of strategic maneuver, they started focusing more on programming and content regulation and looking at how broadcasters held on to their licenses, which in a sense was structural as well. But I think it's part of this longer trajectory where media reformers began retreating from these kinds of structural interventions.
Nonetheless, it was the case that there was still a kind of undercurrent regarding critical thinking regarding the media. And there was one other initiative that actually has a lot of connections to Chicago, which is where I'm at right now, regarding what's referred to as the Hutchins Commission. Chicagoans, and certainly folks at the University of Chicago, know about Robert Maynard Hutchins, who was a former president of the University of Chicago, and who had convened a commission regarding newspapers and journalism from newspapers in the 1940s. Could you talk some about the Hutchins Commission, what it was, why it was formed, what it did, and what were the long-term consequences?
Yes, so the Hutchins Commission actually carries on, at least in academic circles, to some degree. And, you know, for generations, journalism students would learn about the Hutchins Commission, or probably more likely they would hear about the Four Theories of the Press, which came out later in 1956, but was very much inspired by the Hutchins Commission's final general report. But the commission, as you noted, was a convening of leading intellectuals of the time. Robert Hutchins was friends with Henry Luce, oddly enough, who's the publisher of Fortune and Time Life magazines. Certainly wasn't known as a progressive, but yet he was willing to fund this commission under Robert Hutchins' leadership to explore what the freedoms and responsibilities of the press should be in a democratic society, in American society. And again, trying to get at these bigger normative questions about, you know, what should the press be doing? What should it be giving back to the public? What is its role in a democratic society? And what you find, and actually this is something that people would only know if they were to read through the unpublished proceedings from the commission. The commission met dozens of times over about a three-year period. And initially they were considering some fairly radical measures. They were considering subsidizing newspapers, especially in one newspaper towns. They were talking about forming various citizen news councils to oversee the press. And they were, even though a lot of this focused on print media, newspapers in particular, they were also looking at the press writ large. They were looking at all forms of news media. They had separate reports on radio and film and international communications. So they really grappled with some of these big debates about how do we regulate the press? Not only what is the role of the press in a democratic society, but what is the role of the public and the role of government to try to moderate those relationships? And ultimately, they ended up with fairly watered-down proposals that essentially fell back on these notions of self-responsibility in the press. And I think we're still dealing with that legacy today.
I'd like to ask some questions of kind of like more than just recounting about what the book is reporting, but also some deeper questions that are raised by issues in the book. Like, for example, this is a kind of time of ferment and activity in the 1940s. At the same time, there were times of ferment also earlier within the 1920s and 30s that affected media and particularly radio, as well as certainly in the later 1960s that a lot of people consider as a time of tremendous ferment that led to, like, for example, the establishment of public broadcasting in the United States. How does the scale of what was going on in the 1940s compare to what happened before in the 1920s and later in the 1960s? It was, I imagine, smaller, but how do they compare in size, in impact? Talk about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, that's a great question. In some ways, it's hard to measure exactly for a number of reasons. I think, first of all, much of what we see in the 40s is kind of a lost potential. I think that in many ways, the reform initiatives were snuffed out by this anti-communist fervor that was taking hold, especially by the late 1940s. I'd say 1947, 48 was a big turning point. So much of it is kind of seeing, what could have happened. You had this social democratic promise that was rapidly coming together, and then just as rapidly was torn apart by these very repressive red baiting maneuvers. But to compare it to the 1930s, in some ways for media, it was the 30s was more radical moment in the sense that and again I would refer your listeners to the historical work done by Robert McChesney, who really looks at this moment in the early 30s when American society, political elites in particular, were seriously considering a much more public broadcast system, radio system at that time. To say that we almost ended up with the BBC system would be an exaggeration, but we certainly came closer to that model than anyone would assume today, given our predominantly commercial media system. And then to compare it, one last thing I'll say about the 30s is that much of those media reform efforts were being led by educators. And I think by the 40s, even though they weren't going after quite the same level of structural reforms, although they certainly approached it, I think you could safely say that the 40s saw a broader coalition that actually contained more radical elements. I mean, you had radical progressive activist groups as part of this media reform coalition in the 40s. I don't think you had that in the 30s. Now cut to the 1960s, and I think what you saw there was a media reform movement that was much more bound up in these larger social movements. Everyone knows about, of course, you had anti-war movements going on, civil rights movements, various kinds of progressive movements. For many of those reasons, I think you had a more effective media reform movement in the late 60s and early 70s. But the last thing I would say, though, about the relationship between the 40s, this earlier reform movement in the 40s, and what happened in the 60s, was that many of the seeds, so for example, the public broadcast system, I think you can trace that back to at least some of the initial ideas for this kind of public media system were incubated in the 1940s. So I think there are these causal, or at least there are these threads, these connections between those two media reform movements that I think historians have only begun to really trace.
The other thing that I find helpful about this book is it really speaks to the fact that timing can be everything, and that's quite everything, but a lot in the way of whether or not activism takes off or gets smothered. The 1940s, the activism here was no doubt smothered by the kind of red-baiting anti-communist fervor that snuffed out a lot of left liberal progressive initiatives in the wake of this anti-communist buzzsaw. The fact is, though, that there was that ferment there, and had things been differently, it really could have shone a light. And it kind of speaks to one point regarding what you term here, and what you mentioned Bob McChesney also is termed, as a critical juncture, a kind of aligning of the planets, if you will, where the opportunity for success in activism is increased tremendously. I wanted to talk with you about critical junctures regarding this, especially where, do you think that the 1940s did meet that criterion for a critical juncture, as in other times in history? And do you think that the lessons, both successful and not successful, could be brought to a kind of critical juncture that we're seeing now in our current day and age?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and many people are wondering about those precise issues. Whenever you're talking about critical junctures, we have to keep in mind that, of course, it's a metaphor. It's not something that we can scientifically prove one way or the other, and it's often something that you can only really know in retrospect. But in general, it comes out of historical institutionalism and sociology. McChesney has popularized the idea, and in general, it refers to this notion of social, technological, and political change all happening at the same time. It's often a very brief window, and so because decisions that are made during these brief windows will often have an sort of inordinate impact on the way a media system develops, they really hold they hold profound implications. They can set the trajectory. They can create these path dependencies that will hold for decades, if not generations, to come. And so, yes, I think based on these criteria, the 1940s, for media at least, certainly does qualify as a critical juncture. You had technological change with the rise of FM radio and television just around the corner. You had social change with all these social movements that I've sort of referred to, or at least implied earlier in our discussion. You had a very strong labor movement at this time. The civil rights movement was picking up steam, especially after World War II. And then finally, you had this critical mass of progressive commissioners at the FCC. I don't think we've ever seen this since. In the 40s, you had 7 commissioners as opposed to the 5 that you have today. And 4 of those 7 were reliable progressive votes at the commission. So you really had this fleeting window of opportunity in the 40s where they were able to advance these fairly progressive, even radical reform initiatives. Now, the question about whether we're seeing something similar today, again, I think it's open for discussion, and it won't be clear for at least a number of years until we can actually look back to see what happened and try to make sense of this moment that we're currently in. But I do think it has some of the basic requirements for what we consider to be a critical juncture. We're seeing very dramatic policy battles and decisions being made. I think net neutrality, of course, is kind of exhibit A for something that we later might see as part of a broader critical juncture for future historians to ponder over.
Now, last question here, kind of a deeper question as well. It seems like, especially going back to the kind of anti-communist buzzsaw in the 1940s that kind of cut down a lot of the initiatives, not only in the FCC, but also certainly affected the trajectory of things, perhaps for our society and perhaps in history. Things would have turned out a lot more differently if that buzzsaw hadn't been there. It kind of speaks that the kind of issues we've been talking about regarding media, it seems like are themselves shaped more, maybe not so much shaped by, deeper issues, the kind of anti-communist fervent that we've seen, that perhaps a sense about criticism of government and criticism of other factors that could play into it. Do you think that kind of media serve more as a kind of mirror of what's happening at the time, or does media also help to shape about it? How do the factors play into each other?
Yeah, so that's a tough one. I mean, to use a fancy kind of academic term, I would say it's dialectical. So that they're really bound up. They're both creating and being created by the forces that drive social movements. So I think for them to be effective, again, I think that's why you see in many ways a stronger media reform movement in the 60s than you did in the 40s, is that they need to be very much firmly intertwined with these other social movements, or rather the media reform initiatives need to be part of the agenda of these broader social movements to really be effective. But I also think that media deserve to be considered in their own category. The cliche, of course, is that regardless of what your first issue might be, media reform needs to be your second issue, because you're not going to get very far. You're not going to be able to advance your particular politics if you don't have access to media, both being able to create your own media, but also to have access to used to be called mass media institutions. These things are inextricably intertwined. But I think that that we need to think of all these social issues simultaneously and push on all of them at the same time to have effective social movements.
You've been listening to an interview with Victor Picard, America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform, recorded on March 18, 2015. Victor Picard's website is VictorPicard.com. And now, a special message about this program from the trenches.
Hello again. This is Mitchell Strapajczyk. I've been a contributor to the show From the Trenches off and on for the past 11 years, and I've been producing From the Trenches for the past 5 years. From the Trenches first aired with a broadcast on April 30th, 2001 on our first and longest broadcast partner, WLUW 88.7 FM from Loyola University, Chicago. And it is my sad duty to announce, nearly 14 years to the day after the show's first airing, that WLUW management has removed From the Trenches from the station's broadcast schedule, effective immediately. I first heard word of this removal just 6 days before the scheduled airtime for the episode that you're hearing now. The ostensible reasons for the removal were detailed in an email I received. To quote portions of the email, quote, "We at WLUW are moving in a new direction that is centered on the student and college music scene. It pains me to say this, but after careful consideration, we have concluded that your specialty show takes time away from student DJs who could be hosting weekly shows focusing on music. Furthermore, after listening to multiple broadcasts of your show, we feel the content of your show does not align with how we want the station to be portrayed. For the sake of consistency and audience, we will be dedicating the 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. block to DJs who are playing music." Unquote. The problem, among many, is that the reasons outlined don't make sense. For example, WLUW is moving in a new direction centered on the student and college music scene. Well, the student and college music scene has been WLUW's raison d'être for years now. Even a cursory check of the WLUW website shows that. What's more, From the Trenches uses a grand total of 1 hour of the 720 hours in the month of April, comprising just 0.13% of WLUW's total airtime in the month. How can one move in a new direction if the reclaimed airtime is barely above a tenth of a percent? WLUW says that From the Trenches takes time away from student DJs who could be hosting weekly shows focusing on music. Would that were true. In the 5 years I have produced From the Trenches on the fourth Sunday of the month, it's been apparently a struggle to get student DJs onto weekend slots, even with From the Trenches in the lineup. The show immediately preceding From the Trenches is a musical variety program in Spanish, whose hosts include a gentleman older than me. There have been stretches of time, sometimes months at a time, that have seen From the Trenches immediately followed by a musical automat. It seems dubious at best that removing From the Trenches is going to improve these prospects much. WLUW says that, for the sake of consistency and audience, we will be dedicating the 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. block to DJs who are playing music. Audience? I have yet to hear Arbitron ever calculate the audience numbers for college radio stations. Not once has a concern for audience numbers ever been an issue in any decisions I helped in producing From the Trenches. If WLUW wants to build its audience, it should be doing as much as possible to diversify its lineup, not consolidate it. Consistency is the death knell of radio, and more so for college radio. The more diversity of programming and content on a station, the more reasons different people will want to listen. I myself have cared more for public affairs programming and less for music, and up until now, WLUW found time to accommodate both to the benefit of the station and its audience. WLUW steps away from diversity to its detriment, and possibly to its peril. With less diversity of content on the station, fewer people will care about the content, and ultimately about the station. WLUW has already burned more than a few bridges, just ask the folks at Chirp. This removal of From the Trenches won't help. And it's not just From the Trenches. A number of other WLUW public affairs shows received the same verbatim cancellation notice, including one that doesn't even air in the 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. block. I co-signed a petition protesting the mass cancellation. The petition asked for a meeting with WLUW management and a one-month delay of the cancellations. I had hoped to get a better explanation as to why WLUW was ending its broadcast From the Trenches. WLUW management dismissed the request. It appears a better explanation isn't forthcoming. It is shameful for a radio station affiliated with a Jesuit institution, Loyola University Chicago, that prides itself on a mission of social justice and helping humanity, to remove a radio show, indeed a great many shows, that have taken that mission to heart. But far be it to launch a WLUW revenge project. Frankly, there are bigger fish to fry, in a world rife with injustice and calamity, and with the potential for a better tomorrow. From the Trenches has sought to highlight those problems and injustices, to encourage and celebrate activist successes, and to capture the history of these efforts that might otherwise go lost. This episode, and indeed our entire 14-year run, speaks testament to that. Those efforts will continue to promote solidarity, fight injustice, and strive for a better tomorrow. How those efforts will take shape is an open question. I have to say, I'm not sure how From the Trenches will change in light of this decision. It may change from its current once-a-month hourly format, or change in other ways. Details on the future of From the Trenches, as they are made available, will be posted on the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indiemedia.org. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. Special thanks to Rita Sand, Bree Hayden, Kemi Adiokun, Chris Giovannis, Don Goldhammer, and all the people who have contributed to From the Trenches, past and present. And thank you for listening.